Hey, everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
Welcome to the Invested Podcast, where we are actively pursuing knowledge about investing.
Oh, yes.
Warren Buffett style. Yeah.
I like. Yes. Actively pursuing knowledge.
We did a bunch
of
Charlie Munger quotes about all this, these things, and I've sort of grown a little weary of the Charlie Munger quotes, to tell you the truth, but it is true that Charlie and Warren believe that if you just keep learning in your life, you're going to be successful. If you just keep learning, you just keep plugging away. And I think that's the value of a podcast like this, is that we just keep peeling the onion here, unfolding the knowledge as we understand it, that Charlie and Warren have written about and spoken about for 60 years, which I've been using for investing for 40 years. Written a lot about it. And I think, you know, it never stops being interesting to me. And I just keep learning. Honestly, I'm learning. You guys know the best way to learn something is to teach it, right? Everybody knows that. So teaching Danielle here and having her learn and feedback what she's learned to me. And it's been really interesting. And anyway, today we dive into Michael Burry a little bit.
Yeah, I also really enjoyed doing the quotes, by the way, but we felt it was time to move on. And I, at some point, episodes and episodes ago, I think somebody wrote in a question about Michael Burry and what he was up to. And we said, oh, that would be really interesting to look at his 13F SEC filing. And we were both like, yes, let's do it at some point. So today I looked it up, just thinking maybe we would talk about it on the podcast. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, he owns a bunch of Tesla. That really surprised me because he didn't seem like the kind of investor that I would expect to be gung-ho on Tesla. And I was looking at it on, I'll just say the website because whatever. I was looking at it on Whale Wisdom, which, as people who have listened to me talk about 13F filings know, I hate looking at stuff through like a third party lens. And I found out why again today, because I was super confused about what this meant. And then I saw that they have put and call in parenthesis next to a bunch of company codes, company names. And then I realized that it was next to the Tesla name. And I realized he doesn't actually own Tesla. He owns a bunch of puts on Tesla. So to make sure I was understanding all of this right, I then went to the Edgar SEC website because that is the source. And if anybody wants to look this up, his company, and by the way, the way that I find this stuff out is super simple. So his fund is called Scion Asset Management. There's a bunch of Scions if you only put that in. So it's Scion Asset Management. And the way that I found that out is I just Googled Michael Burry 13F, and that's what came up, and that's what Whale Wisdom has. So that's what I found on the SEC. So very easy to figure it out. And it turns out that, yes, on the SEC's filing, which for me is much easier to read, they do put and call options on there if they're owned by a fund. I don't know if I'm just reading the wrong 13Fs, but I had never noticed this before. So there you go. 13F has put and call options. You must have known about this, but I just never put it together. So it's kind of blowing my mind a little bit right now. It's very interesting.
Well, I have to confess that if we were to go over to the toolbox, right, at rule1investing.com and look at guru stocks, Michael Burry's filings on 13Fs would be in there. But our website doesn't bring in the puts in the calls side of this thing. I think originally we just thought, let's just stay with the stock side of things. It's just, it indicates the main focus of the fund. And besides, there's a lot of misleading information that gets thrown out there.
As I just discovered.
Puts and calls. On well, puts yeah. and calls.
So then I started looking it up because I was trying to figure out what on earth this meant. And I found some blogs and some info about how to read it. And it turns out the amount of money that they report on this is the value of the underlying stock. It's not the value of the option. So it could show a huge position in, for example, Tesla, when really there's no position of that anywhere close to that size. So it is misleading. It's really intriguing to me that I've gone this long without encountering this in any 13F.
Well, it's fascinating that Whale Wisdom is putting it up there. I think that's really cool. And I'm rethinking maybe we should put it up on ours as well. But a couple of things come up that are really, really important about Michael Burry. I mean, first we've talked about him. He's one of the major players in The Big Short. And I always forget the name of the actor that plays him, who is also
Christian Bale.
Yeah, Christian Bale, who did a fantastic job playing some sort of OCD or AID? I don't know. Like a guy that thinks differently, you know, like an Elon Musk sort of a
character.
He's
brilliant, basically, is how brilliant. I would put it.
Right. He was so brilliant that hedge funds were giving him money while he was going through medical school at Stanford and investing on the side. And he was so good at it. So the guy's a genius. And in The Big Short, he had figured out a way and basically created a way by working with Goldman Sachs to short the real estate mortgage bonds. I mean, he actually just totally created it. Goldman Sachs thought he was crazy, but happy to take his money. And then later on in the movie, you watch him getting furious that Goldman Sachs won't pay off on the bet that he made with them, that he's obviously won. And later on, what he found out was that Goldman was getting rid of their side of the bet rapidly out to other people.
Right.
And then once they were rid of it all, right, they'd made a bad bet and they wanted to unload it. Once they were rid of it all, then they repriced the bet properly and he made several billion dollars. And amazingly, no one at Goldman Sachs went to jail. I mean, that is so illegal and so wrong on so many levels. And it's just, infuriates me that these guys would manipulate a market like that and get away with it. But of course, the SEC is busy busting little guys and they're not going to deal with Goldman. Goldman got in trouble with the SEC on something else. And the SEC said, send us the paperwork. And Goldman Sachs sent them 2 semi-truck loads full of paper down to Washington, D.C. and said, here you go.
Where are you getting this from?
I've read it. Okay. I don't remember where.
You've exactly read it.
All right. So that's one thing that is important about Michael Burry is he's brilliant and called the mortgage bond collapse absolutely correctly and made an insane fortune for his people. The second thing about
and
him
made
is he's
a huge
massive,
name for himself. So that's right, how he is a known investor.
And he's a massive contrarian, even with his own investors. They hated him and didn't mind the fact that he made them hundreds of millions of dollars of profit didn't matter. They refused to even say thank you. I mean, they hated him because they were adamant that he not make this bet with their money. And he stonewalled them, as you can see in the movie. So he really walks his own path and doesn't worry too much about what his investors have to say about anything, which makes him fascinating to watch out here. So, okay,
well, and
so
the amazing thing is that after all of that, the aftermath was that it was such a miserable experience, despite being correct, that he shut down his fund.
Right.
And didn't have any sort of public documents of his investing for a few years. And now he's coming back into it and we're able to see what he's doing again, which is exciting.
He's reopened and he now has from the last filing, which is sort of end of March this year, he's showing discretionary assets under management of $639 million. And that's important to know. One of the really key things to understand about looking at the 13F filings or what the gurus are doing is to understand how much total capital that they have to work with. Because if they're showing that their largest investment is 34% in ABC company, it's 34% of what they have in stocks invested in stocks and calls, puts, whatever they've got, it's 34% of that number, not including cash. Amazingly, the great flaw in all this analysis is they don't include cash as an investment. And of course, it is an investment, but they don't include it. And as a result, right now, although Burry has $639 million, our website shows that he has a portfolio value of $135 million.
Because the SEC filings don't show any percentages.
We do them ourselves. Because it's super important that we understand what percentage of the portfolio is invested in certain things, right? I mean, it's one thing to have somebody have 1% of the portfolio in a stock. It's another thing entirely if they've got 15% in it.
Yeah, totally.
Like the level of commitment is huge, hugely different.
It's a second level calculation, though.
So our website is showing that Burry has a portfolio of $135 million. We know he's got a portfolio of $639 million. What that means is that if we exclude the puts and calls, all the options that we're going to talk about in a minute, that Burry is sitting on a gigantic pile of cash, it appears, from where we're sitting, right? In other words, if his portfolio is $639 million, he has $135 million invested in stuff, in stocks, then there's $500 million that he doesn't have anywhere, at least as far as our website is concerned. So that's an error, and we need to get better at showing that, number one. And number two, it'd be a really big error if you looked at $135 million and you assume that, oh yeah, the guy has, 8.5% of his money invested in CoreCivic. Well, no, he doesn't have 8.5% of his money invested in CoreCivic at all. Not even remotely close. If he's got 8% of $135 million invested in CoreCivic. You following me here?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's such a gigantic difference. I mean, he's got like $7 or $8 million in CoreCivic. $7 or $8 million. As opposed to what would be 8% of $600 million to be, you know, $50 million.
Mm-hmm.
Just gigantically different.
So you're saying that the values themselves are only really understandable by putting together what percentage of that portfolio it really is. Because for a different example, let's say something's worth $8 million at Berkshire, it's nothing. It's like less than nothing.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because Berkshire is a great example. Buffett invests very rarely.
Yeah, true.
And when he does, he invests billions of dollars. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, he's got Ted and Todd who are handling like $10 billion each. And they're often investing, you know, relatively small amounts. It would be rounding errors at Berkshire.
Yeah.
They'd be just rounding errors. You wouldn't even consider them just Buffett putting a toe in the water, nothing committed.
I mean, they don't say that those are their investments. That's an assumption, but I think it's a reasonable assumption.
Yeah, it is. I mean, look at Apple. One of those guys started into Apple back when it was at 95 or 100 pre-split and then talked to Warren about it. And he got excited about the idea that Apple is no longer a technology company. It's no longer all about creative destruction. I think Warren said that when he realized that a friend of his who had a private jet said he'd let go of the private jet before he'd let go of his iPhone, that there was something going on here, right?
That's
so
cute.
sort of back to Burry. So we've got some interesting stuff here. When we go and look this up, apart from, you know, or going out to the SEC, we see something else. We see that at Whale Wisdom, for example, they're showing that Burry's portfolio is actually almost $1.4 billion. Not $639 million. He has $1.4 billion invested, is the way they're saying it here. And this is also completely screwed up.
Yeah, that's not right. It's because they have a computer doing that, and it must have included the option filings.
It does. And here's the crazy thing. When you do an option filing, what they do, what you just said, they take the value of the underlying as an obligation for you, whether you're obligated or whether you have a right, right? These are the two sides of any options trade. One side is when you sell an option, you're now obligated to do something. And when you buy an option, you have a right to do something. Well, the SEC doesn't seem to distinguish between the two at all. It's just, let's look at the underlying stock and determine the total amount of the investment based on the shares of stock times the underlying price. Mm-hmm. And you end up with these massive numbers that aren't real, right? They're especially not real because the put options and the call options do different things depending on whether you buy them or sell them. And they do very different things between each other. So a put is very different than a call, and a sold put or a short put is very different than a long put. I mean, I don't know if we want to get in the weeds here, but they're very, very different than just saying, well, oh, the underlying stock shares are what really count here.
Right.
So let me give an example.
But I don't think that they would show on here a sold put or a sold call. I think they would only show ones that have been bought and therefore are owned by the fund.
No. They're not going to distinguish. Both. They're not going to distinguish when you push the sold button, when you push sell, and you have to file that you've sold something, whether you owned it or not.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. So now I could be wrong, but and we can check
that's
it out.
That's something sure. I should look up. Yeah.
Yeah. But when they say that the top buys for Burry in Q1, the number one top buy was Tesla.
Right.
he not only didn't buy Tesla, which would indicate he's really excited about Tesla, right?
Which was my initial thought upon seeing this, like 100% wrong.
It's a put option that he bought.
Mm-hmm.
And a put option.
Or sold, if what we're saying is that maybe this means sold as well.
Well, there's very unlikely that he... Well, if he sold it, it would have said sell.
Yeah, maybe.
So when it says buy, he's buying a put option. And the difference between buying a put option and selling a put option are night and day. It's like the difference between buying a stock and selling a stock. In the sense that one is saying one thing and the other is saying the exact opposite, right? So when you buy a put option, what you've done when you buy any option is you've bought a right for something. You've got a right. Okay, so he bought a right on Tesla. And when he bought a put option, his right is to sell Tesla at a set price over some period of time. Like he's got a certain number of days. It might be, you know, 700 days, it might be 30 days. I don't know how many days this thing is lasting, but he has a right to sell Tesla. So imagine if you wanted to insure a position that made money so far, one of the ways you could do it is you can marry a put option to your stock and sell, or rather buy a put option, in which case, if the stock price goes down, you will be able to force someone to buy that stock from you at that higher price, whatever that price is that you set. Hmm. So it becomes an insurance policy to get out, right? It's a way of saying, oh, I want to be insured for the next year that I can get out of this company and retain my profits.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to pay for that. And sometimes it makes sense. And a lot of times it doesn't. Where options get used mostly is in gambling. And my guess here is that I don't even have to guess.
It's not a guess because we know that he doesn't own underlying Tesla. Yeah.
Exactly. So if he doesn't own the underlying Tesla and he bought a Tesla put, then he is spending money with a bet that Tesla is going to go down like a brick and he's going to be able, let's say, you know, Tesla's at, I don't even know what Tesla's at. I don't follow Tesla at all. Do you know Tesla prices?
I don't follow it as a matter of principle.
Let's take a look here where it's at today.
All right, but so it's not gonna tell us anything about $644.
Yeah, so it helps. At least it helps me to understand these things. Tesla's at $644. So let's say Michael Burry says, okay, Tesla's gonna go down. I'm gonna buy a put option at 600. So if Tesla, now why not 644, right? What, much more expensive to buy one right at the money at 644 than it is out of the money at 600. You're almost certain to be able to exercise this thing. If the stock stays around 644, you can exercise it and force somebody to let you out. But you have to pay for that, so it wouldn't make any sense. So what, well, I can't say it wouldn't make any sense. It would make a lot of sense if it drops like a brick. So let's say stock price, yeah. He has a 600, an option to sell the stock at 600 that he doesn't own, right? You don't have to own it. You're just setting up a gamble. It's called a derivative trade. And if the stock goes to 500 over the time period that that option is in play, maybe it's a 6-month option, then what Michael can do is force someone to buy that stock from him, right? He could actually exercise, he could actually go out and buy stock at 500 and then immediately force someone to buy it from him at 600. But what happens more often is that they won't even go buy the stock. They'll just resell the option. They'll just say, okay, I bought this and I paid X amount of dollars. Now this thing has dropped $100 below my strike price. I'm going to sell it and I'm going to get a little bit of money for the time left on the option, and I'm going to get the $100 difference between the strike price and where the stock is right now at 500. I'm going to collect that. They actually make a little more money by just selling the option out to the market. And so that's an incredibly effective gamble, isn't it? When you think about it, that might have cost him $20 to buy that option, and he made $100 on it. Pretty good.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So that's why he might be doing it. Now, what happens if it doesn't go down? Well, he loses his $20. So it's a gamble. He's buying insurance on a house he doesn't own at the expectation the house is going to burn down. Now, you can't do that with houses because it would encourage you to go burn the house down. Right?
Also known as insurance fraud.
Insurance fraud. Because I got insurance, then I burned the house down, and then, hey, you owe me. So the insurance companies won't let you do that. But you can do it in the stock market, which is kind of fun.
We also have no clue how long these options are or what he bought them for, what the strike price is, anything. Like, we know nothing about them. They could be giant long leap options and go out years and years. Like, we have no clue. But
well, they won't go out years and years and years. They might go out 2 years because there's a limit to the time that are on these options and American options.
Aren't there 3-year leaps? No.
You'll see 3 calendar years, but the longest is like 800 days, something like that.
Oh, okay. So a little while anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In which case you'd pay a lot for it if it's anywhere near the money. So
that's, but I mean, as with anything with these 13Fs, they're meant to be, I mean, not meant to be, we use them as, first of all, as something you can copy if you want, but mostly to be instructive, to get ideas, to see what people are doing and not doing. And it's, I don't know, I find it very interesting that he's put this bet on Tesla.
Yeah, it's a nice Tesla bet. Now, he's also got an interesting bet on Google on a different kind of an option called a call option.
Yeah.
Which it also says that he bought. And what that means is whenever you buy an option, you have a right. And a call option, the right that you have is a right to do
buy.
What? Buy to the buy. Stock at a certain price. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's say he sold a call option or bought a call option on Google, and Google priced, where's Google right now? Let's see, $25.97. So let's say he bought an option at 3,000. So if the stock goes above 3,000, at far enough to, you know, cover the cost of the option, he starts to make money. So let's say the option costs him $100 to buy a call option for a year at $3,000 a share on Google. Now he has a year. If that stock goes above 3,000 plus the 100 he paid for it, he begins to make money on that $100. So if Google goes to 3,500, he might make $400 on a $100 bet. So there's another bet that he's making, a leveraged bet.
And here's an intriguing one, which I think is what you were just talking about a few minutes ago. On CVS, he, if we go with this idea that he's been buying them, so let's assume that, he bought a call option on CVS and also owns the underlying stock. The amount that he owns, according to this chart, which may not be right, but the amount that he owns is very, very small. So to me, this seems like a pretty clear covered call.
Wait, he bought a call option.
That's what it says. Yeah. If we're going with the idea that as soon as he, that the chart shows that he's buying, which I'm
right.
Not sure.
So CVS, I'm looking for where that one is. CVS call. And you're sure he's long the call?
I'm not sure. We're not sure about that.
Well,
but
does it say he bought it?
On here, it says that he bought it. Yeah.
Okay. Let's assume that he bought it.
I'm saying we're assuming that. And then he owns the underlying stock. It's about halfway down.
So he owns 110,000 shares of CVS.
Yeah.
Which I can see on our website. And then he, let's say, bought calls on CVS for another 400,000 shares. You with me?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Now, this is not a covered call.
Is a covered call when you sell a call?
Right. Okay. A covered call is when you sell the call. So what he's got is essentially a bet that he wants more of CVS. He wants to be able to buy CVS at a set price for a long period of time. And he is, there's a couple of reasons why he might do that. Instead of just buying the stock, he's using his money that he's got, this 690 million or whatever it is, 640 million. He's using that lots of different ways and using it all up. And so rather than buy another 400,000 shares of CVS and use up a big chunk of it, he's using up a small amount of it to buy the option to buy CVS down the road.
Ooh, I like it.
So
that's intriguing.
Quite intriguing, right?
Yes.
We do something like that. We do exactly like that when we want to leverage up with options. The closer to what we call the money, that is where the stock price is on that underlying stock, we call it at the money. The closer you are to the money, the more an option like that will cost you,
mm-hmm.
right? And therefore, the more the stock price has to move up in order to break even. Another way to do it is to not leverage quite so much and go deep in the money and basically pay about half of the stock price and buy a call option for a couple of years. And we found that really you almost have no downside there. There's your payoff, I'm not going to go into it all right now, but your payoff is going to happen pretty close to equally to buying the stock outright, no matter what happens, unless the stock price really collapses, in which case you're better off with the option, strangely enough. So it's a way to get leverage of 2-1 without really taking any risk at all, much that the stock price is going to not move enough to cover your cost. So this CVS call is really a way for Burry to leverage. Now, if he sold the call and it was a covered call, he would have sold 100,000 shares. He would have sold short 100,000.
I mean, the reason I'm a little suspicious of our assumption that this is all buys is that there isn't a single sale on here. So I don't know. Maybe that's just how it is.
Wait, that's not the case, is it?
Of the options, it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm looking here at Whale Wisdom. And what I'm seeing is that he sold short Citibank or Citigroup calls. He sold short Pfizer calls. So I'm seeing some short calls here.
Oh, maybe I'm looking at a different page because I see none of those.
Now, what's really interesting on these short calls is these are not covered calls either. he doesn't have the calls covered and he's short.
Oh, here they are. They're on page two.
Page two.
The third party website strikes again.
Yeah, exactly. So when you sell a call, you now have an obligation. So when you sell any option, you're now obligated to do something. When you sell a call, you're obligated to deliver the stock at that price.
Okay, this makes a lot more sense to me now that I'm seeing these ones with the sells. So I think then we are making the right assumption that...
Should be.
Yeah, I think so.
But I just want to point out, this is a pretty serious bet that Citigroup won't go up, because he's betting that he's basically giving someone the right. They're paying him for the right to force him to give them that stock at a price. And if he doesn't own the stock, he's got to go out there and buy it at whatever price it's at. So in this particular case, if Citigroup goes up really fast, something wonderful happens, and the stock price goes up really fast, he's going to lose money on that thing. He's going to have to buy the stock, or he's going to have to pay the difference and get rid of that option. Either way, he's going to lose.
It was also reported back, this is a Q4 reporting, because I guess they aggregate their reporting.
This one is actually on March 31st that I'm showing.
Then why? What am I looking at that is different than yours?
You're looking at the SEC, and I don't trust it at all.
There
he's
we differ.
He's got a short call on Pfizer as well. He also doesn't own Pfizer stock. So again, if Pfizer goes up, he loses here. So it's so interesting. You can use options. He's got one option where he's bought an option on Tesla, hoping it'll go down. He's got a call option he sold on Citigroup, hoping it'll go down. He's got a call option on Pfizer, hoping it will go down. And he's got a call option on Google, hoping it will go up. So you guys,
it's a fun little map, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, really cool. I love it. I think it's really cool. But it takes some digging. Now, if you're interested in leveraged investments, where, in other words, these aren't investments per se. These are gambles. These are what I would consider gambling with a brain. Or, in other words, you're going to go to Las Vegas and you're going to count cards and play blackjack and hope the casino doesn't kick you out. And if you stick with it long enough, you're going to make money. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. You've got a really smart guy, a genius, who's got a very strong opinion about the directionality of Tesla and Google and Citigroup and Pfizer. And he's making bets based on that directionality that has to come true within a certain amount of time. So this is a gamble, very speculative, but boy, is it leveraged. You can make a lot of money. And the beauty of options is you can only lose what you put in them, basically. Well,
sort of.
Put options. Yeah. I shouldn't even say that. You can definitely get hammered.
I think you can lose a lot of money. And I mean, I have to say, like, we don't talk about options on here because they are so risky and you have to really understand them. I do think it's really instructive to look at a 13F like this, whether or not one chooses to buy or sell options in your own trading account, just to be able to make sure that we understand what this is saying. Like, what is the accuracy of this document? And obviously, without understanding the option part of it, one cannot understand this 13F.
Right.
So you have to know it.
So do your homework, guys. And a lot of stuff has been written about options. Most of it is pretty obscure. Maybe take a class in it and understand how it works before you start playing around. Oh, and use paper trading before you start using real money. When you do something like options, it'll help you understand it much, much better if you do trades on options on a website like Interactive Brokers or TD Ameritrade or Schwab or something like that. It'll really help you figure it out. Don't do this with money right off the bat. It'll burn you almost certainly.
Good point. Good point.
All right.
All right.
That, time to go
play,
guys.
Well, that was fun. Thanks, everybody.
See ya. Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice, because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.